At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Scottish actor and singer. Did you just say Liam Neeson?
No, it came up saying, do you want to leave the meeting?
So I was like, oh no. I thought as I was introducing you, you said Liam Neeson, because I said Scottish. Liam. Is he Scottish?
He is Irish, which is halfway there.
Well, anyway, we've not got Liam Neeson. I don't know whether I'm sad about that or not, I'm not gonna lie. But we do have Lawrence Smith, and Lawrence is here today to talk about his experience of having diabetes and his experience of diabulimia, and also to discuss sexuality and eating disorders. And I was just saying to Lawrence before we started this podcast, I was really struggling with how to phrase that introduction, because I didn't want to be like, what impact did your sexuality have on your eating disorder? Because that's such a big assumption to say, because that's basically just saying, oh yeah, you know, if you're gay, you have an eating disorder, which is not true in the slightest.
So, or if you have an eating disorder, you are gay. Yeah. I don't know, man. It's a funny old one. But we'll come to that when we come to it.
We shall. So you can all wait for that. hello, anyway. I feel like I blabbered on there about Liam Neeson.
No, that's okay. That's how I like to start most of my conversations, actually.
Yeah.
Just kind of gets the ball rolling, kind of sets the sights quite low, which is good to go from. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. How are you today?
Shall I be totally honest?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Bless you. Yeah. I'm not humdinging. I'm not a 10 out of 10 today.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I'd be upfront about that, but I don't, it's a funny thing. I don't want to be like, oh, I'm not very good today, and therefore I'm going to be really rubbish chat and blah, blah, blah. Because it's kind of like, well, I don't want to give myself permission to not do a good job. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I'm like, oh, I'm not feeling well today, I know that I'm not going to be at my best, but I don't want to wallow in that or kind of excuse some behavior. So I'm just going to, you know what? I'm going to ride on. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not my best, but I'm still going to do my best in the mood that I have in me right now to still, because I can still barrel on through. And, you know, if I said at the start, you know, I'm not going to be good today, that's quite a defeatist label with which to give myself. So maybe if I'm like, okay, I'm not feeling great today, but I'm going to rally and do my best, you know, then that's even though it's a bit of more of a positive spin on I'm not good today. It's like, I'm not good today, but I'm going to try my best.
Absolutely.
To answer your question, that's what I'm doing.
Well, I really appreciate you being honest, because I think, you know, not everybody is 100% every day. And that doesn't mean that you have to, like you said, wallow in it and sit in a corner and not get on with life. You can do the best that you can do today. But also, I think you being honest and saying, I'm actually not, that somebody listening might think, hey, he said it on a podcast that he wasn't feeling 100% today. Like, maybe in life, I can, when people say to me, how are you? I don't have to say, yeah, great, thanks. How are you?
Totally. And, you know, and it'd be disingenuous of me as well, you know, if I'm, the reason I'm on this podcast is because of, you know, I've caught your attention and stuff. And if I'm catching your attention as someone who talks openly about eating disorders and mental health, if I was to be like, yep, I'm fine, I'm totally fine, when I'm not, then again, that's added this disingenuity. And maybe if I'm saying how I'm feeling, mm-hmm. then that might empower someone else to say how they're feeling. And you start to realize that so many people are feeling the same way, especially in the time that we are living in currently.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's predominantly the reason I started this podcast was, you know, if you hear one person say, I was struggling and I got help, then maybe somebody else might go and get help as well.
It's also trying to evade perhaps as well some labels, because my partner has been quite frank with me of being like, just make sure that you are being entirely careful with yourself in all this the awareness raising that you're doing, mm-hmm. that you don't get labeled as the eating disorder guy or whatever, because you know, with the eating disorder, it gave me such a strong identity, or I thought it did. And then battles with recovery, because I was like, well, I was under the illusion that the eating disorder was the only good thing about me, or the only interesting thing about me, or the only remarkable thing about me. So if someone tries to take that away from me, then I have nothing left. And you know, it's really tricky. And yeah, I think the idea of we're going on a tangent. Buckle up, boys. But like, you know, but that's one of the dangers of labeling, because it wasn't until someone said to me, Lawrence, you have an eating disorder, that's when things started to fall into place, and a lot of the chaos that I was experiencing in my life started to make a lot of sense, even though the evidence was all there and I could put it all together, like, I think I have an eating disorder. It wasn't until someone else said it, I was like, okay, here we go, plan of action, you know. Just and hearing those words kind of gave me permission, I think, to engage in that that diagnosis and kind of go, okay, well, if I've got a term for what this is, then maybe there's a way out of it as well. Because if you're kind of living your life feeling very nebulous, or feeling very confused, or feeling like, am I the only person who feels like this? Or is this, am I wrong? What is this? For someone to say, no, this is a diagnosable thing, or this is a recognized state of being. Then in the textbooks, obviously it'll give you the sad reality of a lot of these disorders and conditions, but there are recovery stories and survival stories. So trying to hang a bit of hope onto that. Mm-hmm. So that's how I'm doing today. Thanks for asking.
I'm glad that you have got it out there. If I was the first person you said that to, if I was not, then I'm really glad that you were able to say how you're feeling. So thank you. Talking of labels, I think that's quite a poignant thing for this podcast, because I'm making an assumption again, but would you say that initially you were labeled as a diabetic?
Yeah, I mean, so I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 3 years old.
Oh, wow.
And that's a tricky one as well. So my maternal grandfather, he had diabetes as well, type 1. Okay. So then when I started to exhibit the signs, obviously there was sadness and obviously there was turmoil and stuff in my family, but it wasn't shock as much, or it was a lot of, this is so disappointing on such a strong level. But it was a case of, okay, well, we know what this is. Like, we know what diabetes is. We weren't having, so that, I mean, I was 3 years old. I had no other idea, but my family reacted, I think, in that way.
And just for people listening, and then, what is type 1 diabetes? If they don't know, totally. I think people might know about type 2, but maybe not type 1.
Sure, absolutely. And this is also a tricky thing. Because I was diagnosed when I was 3, asking me about diabetes is like asking me why I've got blue eyes. I'm like, I don't know, I just have that. I guess I've got it. You know, maybe if I had diabetes now with my adult brain, I could maybe be like, oh, okay, it's this. Whereas for so long, it's like, diabetes is the thing that makes me feel funny. Essentially, it's a chronic disease. So type 2 generally is manifest via lifestyle and is controllable in that regard. But type 1 diabetes is genetic, and once you have it, you got it. And it's essentially your pancreas, which is the organ in your body which responds to sugar levels, malfunctions. So when someone else ingests some food or sugar, or like, you know, carbohydrates into sugar, a non-diabetic's pancreas goes, there's sugar in the body now. Hang on, I'm just going to release the appropriate amount of insulin, a chemical, which will fight the sugar and break it down and turn it into useful things in the body. But when a diabetic person, type 1 diabetic person, ingests the sugar, because the pancreas is asleep or dormant or dead, it doesn't then release, it doesn't respond appropriately. So it doesn't send out naturally occurring insulin, which means that the sugar levels will build and build and build and build and build. And so someone else's body is regulating it. A diabetic's body isn't regulating at all. Because on the flip side of that is, say you've been doing some exercise or you haven't eaten in a while, your blood sugar levels start to dip. And I think I've heard other people, non-diabetic people, talking about, oh, I've got low blood sugar, I'm having a sugar crash. I'm like, uh-huh, yeah. But what happens is your body will then go, oh, and it will swoop you out of that free fall, and it will release chemicals which will send sugars back up again, or release sugar stores. But a diabetic's, sorry, I don't know how boring this is for other people.
I'm a biomed student, so I'm living it.
Oh God. Okay. Well, you tell me that. No, I'm kidding. Is this okay so far?
You're all good.
Bless you. A diabetic person, if they've been doing exercise, or if they haven't eaten enough, let's come on to an eating disorder soon. My pancreas doesn't recognize that I'm in free fall, so I will just keep dropping, which is when a diabetic needs to, when you're having low sugar levels, that's when you're having a hypoglycemic attack, and you have to ingest sugar to artificially raise up your body's sugar level. If you're having a hyperglycemic attack, you've got too much sugar, that's when I need to take insulin to artificially bring it back down again. Because what you're looking for that sweet spot. You're looking for it's Goldilocks, not too high, not too low.
Yeah, I was going to say that must be so challenging to know how much.
Yeah, baby. It yeah. is. Yeah, it's a tricky old wicket. It's hard. And once you add on the food stuff, it's kind of not shocking that there's such a high prevalence of, because you're having to think about everything that you eat. And what has been tricky in some recovery scenarios with eating disorder, people are like, just, you know, don't think about numbers, don't think about food, just like, just have a you day. And like, there's not a second of a day that goes by that a diabetic person isn't having to think. And what is interesting is, so I was diagnosed in the early 90s. Oh God. Just revealed my age. In the early 90s, in the Highlands of Scotland. So they were like, I don't know, diabetes? Question mark. Bless. And, you know, so I was 3 years old, so I wasn't really party to a lot of the conversations that were going on. I don't know what it would be like if I was diagnosed now. At my age, as I say, I was a child, so I kind of just rolled with the punches. But what has been very striking to me over the past couple of years is when I've gone in for a diabetic appointment checkup, there's one doctor in particular kind of went, cool, so how are you doing? I was like, oh, yeah, I'm fine. You know, I was a bit sweaty on the tube or whatever. He's like, cool, no, I just meant like, how are you? Because we know how shit diabetes can be. I was like, oh, whoa, like it had taken, maybe that's just a catch up of medicine or this one particular doctor, I don't know. But for someone to kind of recognize, you kind of got a bit of a raw deal here.
Yeah.
How you coping? I was like, it was a very powerful message to receive and very appreciated. But it's a tricky one. Like, as I say, I was three, and my brother, who's 2 years older than I am, he then was diagnosed 6 months later.
Oh wow.
My mum thinks it's Chernobyl. She thinks because we're in the northern hemisphere, like very top of Scotland, like the Chernobyl gas cloud came over, and I don't know. Sorry, mum. Because there were 7 kids in my village. We lived in a wee village. 7 of us all had type 1 diabetes. I don't know, something in the water. Yeah, it was kind of, it was a bit weird, actually.
That is. I only know two people with type 1 diabetes.
Yeah,
we had three a bunch now of them. Because I know you.
Well, bless you. And not to be weird, but my boyfriend has it as well.
Oh, wow.
Which we found out pretty quickly. But it's like I'm collecting them.
So for you, it is kind of, I don't want to say mm-hmm. normal because you've had it since you were three, but if your brother and then your boyfriend as well.
Yeah. It's kind of, I feel it in my fingers. It's everywhere you go.
Yeah.
It's been a constant part of my life. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it has normalized it because, you go on holiday and your brother has the same injection as you do, or, you know, I never felt othered because of it within my family setting. It is annoying that I can't pretend to be like, oh, it's my diabetes. And then my boyfriend's like, we'll do a blood test. See, no, you're not. So there's no sympathy, which is annoying.
Yeah.
Because that's what I want. But it's funny. I don't know. It's a weird one. And it's taken a long time as well for me to have, I have a very combative relationship with it, and mm-hmm. it's in a much better place now than it was. But I've got one of the blood sensor monitors, yeah. the adhesive ones, and that took a long time. They are cool, but I was eligible for one of those. So for the listeners at home, it's a adhesive, like semi-permanent, like comes off every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. but semi-permanent thing that you stick on your arm. And then you've got an app on your phone and you can just press up against the sensor monitor and it tells you what your blood sugars are doing. And previous to that, it would be finger pricks. So you'd be pricking your finger 4, 5, 6, 7 times a day, drawing blood every day, your own blood. It's weird how you just kind of go, this is normal.
What do you call it? Mm-hmm. Sorry, the thing on your arm, what's it called?
Norman, I don't know, like I don't know, like sensor.
Your little white. I think it looks like an air tag.
Monitor. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, little white, but diabetes air tag. That's what you've got.
And even though I was eligible for a long time for the sticker thing for the sensor, I didn't want it because I thought, no, I'm like an OG diabetic. I do my finger pricks. It wrapped its tendrils around my identity, and again. A slight course correction of like, no, there's another way of doing your thing, that you're doing your blood tests. That felt alien to me. I was like, well, that's not the diabetes I know. So it's just, there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff tied into it. But yeah, it's a funny old one. Anyway, continue.
I do think the technology is cool, but also I can appreciate that it must be still a very stressful thing, even though it's cool.
Yeah, there is, and because it's also, if I know that my levels aren't doing very well, I used mm-hmm. to be able to ignore it and be like, oh, okay, I'll do a test later. Whereas now I kind of don't have an excuse. I can do a test right now and see if I'm doing well or not. Mm-hmm. And that's inviting a lot of judgment on myself, which I already I fling on top of me already quite willingly, but then adding on like a diabetic, or am I being a good diabetic or a bad diabetic, and just having 24 hours a day judgment placed upon you and with very real consequences is the annoying thing. It's quite a lot to digest. And as I say, being diagnosed at three, maybe my parents were given information that I couldn't handle as a three-year-old about, you know, the ramifications. But there are very real consequences. But I think you spend a lot of your time being like, oh, that happens to other people. That's another person problem. Mm-hmm. But one of these days, you all become the other person at some point.
So which way do we go with this? I think before we talk about the diabulimia, what are the consequences of not having your insulin?
Sorry, this water smells horrible. Anyway, sorry, cut around that bit. Gordon Bennett. Anyway.
Gordon Bennett, what a saying. My mum says that all the time. Who the hell is Gordon Bennett?
I don't know, but his ears must be burning. Burning ears is a symptom. No, I'm kidding. So what was the question? What was the actual question?
The consequences of, I think the scientific word for it is omitting insulin.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'll talk about it in layman's terms because that's who I am. But in how it makes me feel. The higher that your sugar levels are rising, God, I don't know how I describe it. It's you're so lethargic, you're so thirsty, but your body is desperately trying to flush out fluids. It's trying to get rid of. It's like warning, something's going wrong. Let's just get rid of fluids. I'm sure there's a more scientific reason than that. Ooh, increased thirst, increased trips to the toilet. I get like a tingling. I get a lot of a cloudy brain. So even today at work, you know, people are like, hi, can I get a double shot macchiato and an oat milk latte, hold the foam and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I am going to make you a coffee because that's all I heard. I'm so sorry.
And when you're giving requests like that, that's probably what you deserve.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, come on. There's a pandemic, ma'am. there's a lot of brain fog, a lot of confusion, lethargy, and sometimes it feels like you're tingly or you're spiky and hot and you get very sweaty. It's not fun. And I feel like I can feel my heart beating a lot, but that might just be, I don't know. But but then if that's sustained over a period of time, what can happen is because the body's trying to put out this fire, the body starts to break down other stores of energy to flush out this thing, and it starts to eat away at your muscles and it starts to burn fat. Oh ho! So if you emit your insulin long enough, you start to lose weight. On the flip side, actually, so that's high sugar levels. Low sugar levels, that's a whole other thing, because that's also the brain fog. It's also shakes. I personally feel the effects of a hypo much more acutely than being high, because you're shaken again, the confusion, the sweating, the just blank stares, that's not fun either. And it's scary. You're feeling you're not in control. Because you're not, your body is going, it is in a state of distress. So as much as you want to politely, excuse me, please, and leave the room, it's hard, you know, you're not fully on the ball. So they're scary. And growing up, having hypos as a kid is scary. And you also, your body then, lizard brain takes over being like, you need sugar, babe, get it in you. So you will eat a lot or ingest a lot, or this is me personally, or you'll drink loads of orange juice or fizzy juice, and you will keep going. And the thing is, it takes a little while for your sugar levels to climb back up again, but you don't know that yet. And in the moment, you're like, I just need to eat. And so you will just eat and eat and eat, and there'll be a lot of that involved. Because you think the more I eat, the quicker I will get out of this, even though your body's already coming back out of it. But and lows happen, if we go back to slide A, low sugars happen because, for example, because you might have done too much exercise, or if you haven't eaten enough. So as we're tying this back into eating disorders, ladies and gentlemen, mm-hmm. and folks, the result of, at the start of my eating disorder journey, of over-exercising and under-eating would lead to massive having hypos, mm-hmm. where I would then need to eat to correct what had just gone wrong. So then I'm like, hang on a second, like I've just been running half of Scotland, I need to come home and I need to eat a Twix. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. This doesn't seem fair. And that's tricky. So then what would happen is I'm like, oh, hang on. If I, and I don't like, this is the truth. I don't, we can edit around this if this is controversial. So say 7 is a good number to be at. Anything below 4, hypo, bad. Mm-hmm. So you're aiming for 7. If I'm going along at 7, 7, 7, 7, do some exercise, don't eat enough, I will then dip. And I'll start to dip. I'll dip into a low.
Yeah.
If I'm up at 14 and I don't eat and I exercise, I will dip, but I maybe then will dip into a 7. Oh, that's healthy. And I'll avoid the hypo range. Great. So if I, this is my eating disorder brain. And if I manufacture higher sugar levels so that I'm starting off from a higher place, when I do the exercise, I'm not going to dip as low. So I'm not going to hypo. So what would happen is I would just over time, I would just stop taking as much insulin, because when you eat something, your body sends out the correct amount of insulin. I would send out the incorrect. I would omit insulin. I would take less insulin than I should have. And what would happen is then I would get a bit of a bump of the insulin, but my body would be in panic mode and would be fighting it and would be losing weight. It would be burning fat cells. So that I would stay up here and I would eventually just kind of stop injecting. I would inject my nighttime levels to make sure I didn't die in the night, frankly. But I would seriously mess around with what I should be doing in the perceived goal of, oh, this would be good when I've lost a bit of weight, even though I was causing absolute havoc to my body and my brain. So it's a hard one. And but as I say, with the diabetics journey, there's so much focus on food and what you're having and are you taking enough? Are you doing this? Are you doing the right thing? Are you doing enough exercise? Are you doing too much? It's just, there's a lot of spinning plates. And I think because I wasn't a particularly rebellious child, I think I was quite well behaved, didn't have any vices of any sort, really. When it came to my parents relinquishing control of my diabetes, because they would administer the injections or they would make sure I'm doing the blood tests or they would check in or they'd help me write out my logbook of what my blood sugar levels are and all this, as they started to be like, well, you're a man now, or as I took on the responsibility, I panicked. And rather than spinning those plates, I just let them all drop because I thought, well, that's easy. That's easier to do than to manage all these things happening at once. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a large part of it as well was, I think growing up from 3 years old with everyone around you being like, you could die at any moment, so we're going to have to look after you. That then does create a cushion and a barrier and a safety net, essentially, of my team's got me. Everyone else has got my back. If I kind of make a mistake here or there, someone else will pick up the mess, essentially. And as I started to get older and go into adolescence and all the fun things that puberty brings along with it, and the idea of leaving high school, leaving home, having a career, paying taxes, moving house, finding all that felt so overwhelming. And I realized that my safety net wasn't there anymore because I'm growing up, which is the natural thing to do. So part of my getting ill, I think, was to, again, manufacture this safety net and keep myself in that cushion of being surrounded by care and attention, frankly. A lot of, I think, if I'm totally honest, a lot of it was attention. And I think there's such a bad rap that people get of like, of just attention seeking. It's like, well, yeah, but for a reason. But
not in that way.
Yeah. There are ways to do it, and there are reasons to do it. But I think if someone is in distress, and that's the, I didn't have the vocab. This is me 10, 15 years on from the fact, kind of going, I think this is what I was doing.
Yeah.
I was in such a muddled, as is the case, such a muddled mindset that I was kind of grasping at anything I could. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking back and saying, I think this is what it was. And yeah, so I especially at the time, I just don't think I had the words to say, oh, I need help.
Yeah.
So the tools I had at my disposal included this diabetes, which had been such a negative. No, I don't think it wasn't a negative. It was a force in my life. It was a very present force in my life. If I'm saying it was negative, that might be slightly disingenuous. I don't know. I don't have an alternative. Mm-hmm. It was what it was, but it was present. And I thought, well, I have been saddled with this burden for all my life so far, really. Maybe I can use it to my advantage now in a destructive way. And if you add in, like, I must have been like depressed as a kid. I don't know. And times of bouts of sadness and stuff. And I was prone to self-destructive behaviors. And, you know, I self-harmed and had very low moods and then all this stuff. And one of the, I don't know, the biggest self-harms was doing this thing to my body. Because I think as well, I didn't ask for diabetes. A stupid thing to say, but in this example, I didn't ask for diabetes, but so I was kind of punishing my body or being like, well, if I've got it, I'm gonna fucking use it.
Yeah.
So yes, I think there was a lot of simmering anger, and be it at the diabetes or, you know, it's tricky sometimes to say I'm diabetic, and that's in itself is an identifier, as opposed to I have diabetes.
Yeah.
In the same way, I'm anorexic, I have anorexia, you know, that's how I spent many, many years as well. So if I'm having this hatred of this diabetes or hatred of my mood disorders and stuff, then, well, they're so intrinsically linked to who I am. So if I'm hating on the diabetes, I am hating myself a little bit. Mm. And it's hard to do that when, yeah, I am my safety net. Fuck it. That's what I should be thinking. Like, yeah, I'm looking for all these other things, but it should be me. I should be my biggest champion. I should be my biggest hero. And I should be the one who gets me out of these situations. And sometimes that's hard when you don't feel, or I don't feel, or I didn't feel, or I don't feel. I felt like a Sondheim lyric. Sometimes I'm not kind to myself. And I'm not nice to myself, and I don't think highly about myself. So, but I'm the person who has to get me out of these situations that I've already put myself into. And sometimes that can be really hard. And okay, today I'm going to do this. Today I'm going to rock it. I've never said that in my life before, but today I'm going to do something really, I'm going to do something for me, or I'm going to put these plans in action that I've been delaying for so long, for so long, for so long, for so long. And then just something can trip you up.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, what's the point? You know, and that's really hard, because so when it comes to your long-term health as well, I'm going to be really good today. I'm going to really look after myself today. If you're not feeling good about yourself, if you're not feeling nice to yourself, that can be the first thing to go.
I think what you said about kind of being in self-destruct mode is something I've always thought about eating disorders, that I guess I don't think is really spoken about a lot, but it's the perspective I've always had, in that it is a form of self-harm, because you're harming yourself so much, whether you don't see it maybe as like a physical harm, but it is a physical harm, because, you know, like you've said with the diabulimia, there's short-term impacts, there's long-term impacts, but it's kind of, you just fog over those consequences that are going to happen for that feeling of that self-destruct.
Yeah. For the immediate feeling of I'm feeling shit right now.
Yeah.
You could say like, oh, but you might not be feeling bad and I don't care about in 6 hours time or in six months time. I can't think about that far ahead. I'm thinking right now.
It's now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this is a really, really difficult question. From what you said, and like, tell me if I'm wrong, it sounded as though things sort of started with the excessive exercise and the food restriction, that it was going down the path of anorexia, and then you kind of thought, I feel like there's a different way I can do this with having diabetes. So do you think that you would have developed an eating disorder regardless of having diabetes? And I know that's like the most open question in the whole entire world. That's like saying, I don't even know.
Yeah.
But I guess more what I'm saying is, to me, the way that you've described it, it sounds more like your personality traits like led you down the path of an eating disorder rather than it being you had diabetes and therefore you developed diabulimia.
Yeah, I think I accidentally fell arse backwards into diabulimia. I didn't know that's what I was engaging in. Mm-hmm. If I could be honest with myself, but I wasn't at the time, I knew I had an eating disorder.
Yeah.
It just so happened that I was also neglecting my diabetes at the time because I was neglecting everything at the time. I didn't go for a haircut in like a year because I was like, I don't want anyone to look at me. There's no point in anyone looking at me. And I've left it too long now. If I get a haircut now, then people are going to go, oh, you've had a haircut. And then they're going to look at me. And I don't want anyone to look at me. So I'm just going to keep having this long hair. So, you know, that's an extreme example, but every aspect of my life was, and I'm not a, listeners, you won't know this, but I'm not a particularly snappy dresser, a grey t-shirt. I don't like drawing attention to myself, which is a bit of a irony considering I am a performer and I do all this stuff. And like my partner is saying, it's just the stupidest thing. He's like, you can stand in a auditorium of theater of like 3,000 people belting show tunes, but you can't phone the dentist and it's just my skill set, and I guess I can disappear into a character.
I was just literally gonna say, do you think it's because you're not being you?
No, I don't know. I think it's me showing off. I think I'm like, oh, I'm quite good at this. Here we go. Because I don't know if I ever really completely disappear into a role. There's always me kind of going, oh, you fucked that bit. Oh, that note wasn't quite right. Oh, that worked. That went okay today. Oh, the audience aren't laughing very much. I am hell to work with. I'm so sorry. Oh, I shouldn't have admitted that. But I don't switch off. Like my brain's ping, 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 which I think is a good thing because it means I'm constantly evaluating. Okay, what can be done better? How can this, which is why in terms of, you know, stage work, but also working in hospitality, I'm aware of who's eating what and who needs a coffee and, oh, that customer's just come in. I think they're about to drop their fork. They drop their fork. I'll go get another one. You know, I'm quite good at all this stuff. So, you know, external evaluating, but I am horrendous at internal evaluation. Like I don't know how I come across to other people. So I just naturally assume they don't like me. But so going back to your original question, I don't know. I don't know if it's very chicken and the egg. Do I have an eating disorder because I have diabetes? And it is hard, but it's still I think it's a worthy question, because if it's making me think, and I'm the person who's sitting here chatting about it, I'm like, well, God, that's such a good point. Yeah, I think I personally was prone to self-destruct or self-destructive behaviors, and it just so happened that one of them was this. Because as I say, you know, I was also engaging in other self-destructive behaviors. And
I want to ask you another question, but it's something that we haven't really spoken about on this podcast. And I think that is, I don't know, it's just never really come up. But I think it's quite common in terms of self-harm. The self-harm, how did you stop? Was it once you had the eating disorder, sort of, you were in recovery for that? Did the self-harm go along with that, or did it not coincide?
It's again, it's a tricky one in that receiving care for the eating disorder and the assorted stuff was a very drawn out process. And so it's seeing multiple different services over a period of time, and sometimes being like, oh, I think I'm okay. I think I'm, oh, and then dropping again. The self-harm was intermittent. So I think it wasn't a constant that ran through the whole experience. So okay. it would flare up in times of distress or in times mm-hmm. of, I think again, in times of, I have so many feelings and I do not know what to, and I cannot contain them in this husk of a shell of a body. And a lot of the eating disorder was, I felt that I personally had so much, I felt I had so much excess. I had so much stuff that I'd accumulated over life. And I told myself it was manifesting itself in my fat or in my, what I had on my body. And I was looking for a sense of, which makes it sound so quaint, but I was looking for a sense of purity. I think I wanted to get rid of all this excess, all this negativity, all this stuff. I wanted to do a spring clean, as it were, of my body. And going back to that safety net thing is when I wanted to be a child, because that's when I felt safest, because people were looking mm-hmm. after me. So I think I had a lot of hatred for, not just in terms of, to be totally shallow and boring, but like, you know, Instagram, like, oh, like weight loss. It's not that. It wasn't about my physical appearance. It was about my just physical self. I hated it. And I just wanted to shrink down, get rid of that. And then I can maybe then come back up again in this new and improved version of me. And that didn't really happen. But so I think there was, it's, as you know, it's so hard to rationalize such an irrational time in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, hey ho, but I think, yeah, the self-harm was part and parcel of that, of I was a confused young man, a really sad young chap who didn't know what to do with all these feelings he was having. Mm. And I didn't have the vocabulary to ask for help. I didn't necessarily want help. I didn't think I deserved help. Because as I said earlier, you know, finally I felt that this was giving me a purpose and was giving me an identity and something that they went, oh, Lawrence, he's the thin one, right? Oh yeah, okay. As opposed to Lawrence, he's, which one's he again? I wanted a marker. I wanted something to be memorable. And in terms of cries for help and attention seeking, self-harm is part of that. It's communicating, I am not okay right now, but I don't know what else to do, or I don't. But again, some people would try, they would take up my invitation of talk to me, ask me how I am, and I push them away. Because the Lawrence who did it isn't the same Lawrence who responds to the question, and and it was horrible, and I knew it wasn't the right thing to be doing, but it felt like the only option I had at the time, which is kind of, you can say, for the whole situation, really.
I think you made such a good point there, especially if people are listening and kind of, you know, they're somebody who's supporting somebody that might be going through something similar. Is I often think that with an eating disorder or self-harm or anything like that, it is a internal cry for help. And I'm not saying that in an attempt, you know, all these negative words that we have, cry for help, attention seeking, they've become negative connotations, but they're not in the slightest. Like, it is literally just that you do not have the words to put into place to say, I'm not okay right now, but I can't say that to you. So I'm not gonna, I'm gonna restrict my food intake. I'm gonna punish myself with exercise. I'm gonna harm myself. But equally, with all of that, just because they're exerting, like, giving off those behaviors, it doesn't mean that they're then gonna have the words afterwards. And I think that's something like to really recognize, because you might notice that someone's acting in that way and think, okay, let's have a chat with them. But if they're doing those behaviors, they're probably struggling so much to put it into words that, you know, it's likely that they're going to push you away even more. And that's so hard as somebody who's supporting somebody.
Totally. And because, as I say, even I'm 10, 15 years on, I'm still confused about what I was doing. So asking my friends when we were all teenagers to try and figure out what I was doing, you know, that's such an ask. And again, it's tricky because the roots of an eating disorder or of depression or of self or anything, they're so strong. And if I'm sometimes worried that if a friend or a loved one would try and chop the root of the eating disorder, well, it's wrapped around me.
Yeah.
So you're chopping both of us there. And it takes such a delicate unraveling to separate also who is Lawrence and who is Lawrence without it, the eating disorder. And I'm still, as a, I'm going to say again, 30-year-old man. So we had to pause the podcast as Emily just was blown away by my age. I still kind of go, I wonder who I would have been if I didn't have this. Damn it. You know, oh, it's taken quite a lot from me. And, you know, looking for the positives, I'm trying to find the positives. Even at the worst times, I was trying to find the positives. Okay, like there must be a meaning to this. There must be, I've watched so many films. There must be, everything happens for a reason. What is my act 3 twist? You know, like something has to come from this. So part of it, I think, is me being able to talk about it openly, because I couldn't do that for many, many years. Mm-hmm. But also having the realization of, okay, well, I can sit here and ponder about, gosh, I wonder what my life would have been like if I didn't have an eating disorder, or if I had even one shred of confidence in myself. I wonder what it would be like. Well, honey, the eating disorder has happened. You are, yeah, where you are. So let's keep this train chugging along, because you can't go back. And what I can implement now is, and I'm trying, is to be more confident in myself and to recognize the good things and to have plans and to be working on things. I think, if I'm honest, I have not gotten away with, but I have, a lot of things have happened, or behaviors have happened, or my approach to scenarios occur, and I kind of go, oh, but I had an eating disorder, or I've gotten it, or that's my depression talking, or whatever. And it's like, and as valid as that can be, everyone has their own shit. And the one thing I thought made me special, everyone has their special thing, and which is terrifying for me to admit, and I hate doing it. I hate admitting it, but I cannot use what happened. I can't use things like eating disorders, like depression and stuff, which are valid things. I cannot go through my life using it as a crutch for when other things in my life that aren't touched by these start going wrong or have issues. I have lived with disordered eating now, because recovery, but you know, it's still obviously ongoing. I've lived with it long enough to adapt to it better. So maybe am I declaring on this podcast right now that I'm just having to, I'm just having to be, it's funny, having to be kinder to myself, but also a lot harsher to myself, of mm-hmm. being like, okay, well, that isn't going to cut it anymore. That behavior, you know what it is now. It's not a shock. It's not a surprise. Oh, I didn't really want to do that. Maybe it's because you know why you didn't want to do it. And you knew, actually, the moment when that person asked you, hey, do you want to come around to, or do you want to go out for dinner? You know you're going to say no, but I can't. So I'm smart enough to not be surprised by that, by my reaction. But I know, oh, I don't want to let them down, so I won't tell them until the last minute. Oh, actually, sorry, I'm not feeling great today. I knew I wasn't going to say yes to it, so just own up to it. Or what is the worst that could happen if I just said yes to things sometimes?
Yep.
Someone said to me at work the other day, we were going, that we had a lunch break, we had a 2-hour break in between our shifts. And he's like, hey, do you want to come down? I was like, nope, I'm going to Pret. He's like, I know you're going to Pret. I was going to walk with you to Pret. Oh, Nope, I've got reports to do. I didn't have reports to do. I just didn't want my plan to change. But what I said to him afterwards is like, I'm really sorry, mate. I'm very regimented with my thinking and my food times. I'm just quite regimented about these things. Okay, well, that's one thing, saying I'm regimented about things. But here was a friend saying to me, hey, I want to hang out with you. Can we go get food together or whatever, or just go for a walk? We've got time to kill. And I was like, what would we do? We just end up talking for hours. Yeah, that's fun. That's allowed. I'm allowed to enjoy myself. And yet I put up these blockades the eating disorder puts up these blocks. That's not true. I put up these blocks and blame it on the eating disorder. I can't eat with other people. Yes, I can. I can. It's hard, but I can. Sorry, mood has changed. 180. Like, I'm feeling like let's do it.
No, I really appreciate everything you're saying, because I think it's the harsh truths that we need when we're in recovery that you know, often we're not willing to say. And I actually had a really similar conversation with my friend the other day. How we were saying, realistically, when you look at an eating disorder, why would you want to recover? Because like you've just said, it's a safety blanket. Like, you know, I have a go at my boyfriend, I can just say, oh, I'm sorry, I was just so hungry because I've restricted all day, and I got at you and I'm sorry. And then I'm like, nobody did that but you. Like, I understand that it's a very difficult thing to recover from and it's so hard, but what annoyed me and what I think is my biggest annoyance, I guess, at my eating disorder is do what you like to me, because at the end of the day, like, I'm me. But when I look back and realize the impact I had on my family or my friends or everything, like, you know, I lost every single friend that I had when I had an eating disorder because frankly, I was not a nice person to be around. And at the time, I was like, oh, how dare they? Like, they didn't stick around. Like, what bad friends. But now I look back and I think, you know, I was absolutely horrible. And if somebody does stick around, you know, my boyfriend, he did stick around and I'm so grateful that he did, but equally I can understand why people don't. And unfortunately, I think sometimes we do need that harsh reality. And no, eating disorders are not a choice, but I think sometimes recovery is, and it's really difficult. But like you were saying about going out for lunch with your friend, that was a choice. Whether it felt like it was overpowered by the eating disorder or not, it was still a choice.
Yeah.
To not go.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's just, it's tricky. I think I've said to a friend before, like, it's like, I mean, I don't like this analogy, but it's like, you know, if you go to the gym and you only work on one particular muscle group, that muscle group is going to be really strong. So then lifting that weight is very easy, or when it comes, or that muscle group becomes strong. If someone says to me, hey, do you want to go for a meal? My eating disorder muscle is so strong. It will squish out the rational thought of, okay, what's worse that could happen? Or this could be fun. Or I like my friend. Let's do that. But because just over years and years and years of practice and training, that eating disorder muscle is so strong, and it can override the weaker muscle, you know? So what it's a case of is me reinforcing that muscle that hasn't been used as much, the one that's like, okay, let's try that, you know, and just taking the power away from the eating disorder.
And it's interesting as well what you were saying earlier about, oh, like, what will we do if we go for lunch together? Like, we'll have to talk. And I find it so fascinating talking to people that have had eating disorders or still have eating disorders, because it's like, how, I don't know, it sounds so stupid, but I just get so, I mean, I find it fascinating, which maybe is wrong. I mean, I work in eating disorders, so I guess that's why, sure, I'm there. But like the fact that we have the same thought processes, but we're independent people and nobody's written a manual of, okay, so if you have an eating disorder, this is what you think. Nobody's given the guidebook, but, you know, like panicking about, oh, we'll have nothing to say, or, you know, will they judge me for what I eat, or like, how will I eat around them and everything? I just think it's fascinating that it shows up in the same way. And I don't know what else to say. I just, it blows my mind.
And I think, and it goes as well to like, I'm just so, as an onlooker, so moved or so grateful that conversations have moved on so much in over the time that I've been experiencing disordered eating issues. And for guys, it's still, I think, not as, you know, it still can be a bit surprising to some areas of society. but I know that when I was ill, I was so confused. I didn't know what the hell was happening to me at points, and let alone myself, but also in like in society, I felt very alone. Like, well, you know, I'd sometimes Google like eating disorder man, and it would come up with wild suggestions. Or a lot of it was, to be honest, was along the bulimic side of things, not the weight loss. And I was like, okay, so maybe I don't have an eating disorder because I'm not making myself sick. So, you know, it was just a lot of confusion. So I think the more vocal some people are, or the more vocal people are, not just some people, because that assumes that some people have more of an authority than others. I think if you have a lived experience of this, you are valid. And I know that, and I spent a very long time feeling incredibly guilty, as it were, that I was never hospitalized for it. You know, I never had to be an inpatient on an NHS ward. I was very fortunate to receive some inpatient time on a private ward, but not too much time in case my dad's company's health insurance policy ran out. get better in 3 weeks. But so I have a lot of guilt and a lot of shame about, like, I was anorexic, but I wasn't that anorexic. Who cares? Like, my life was disrupted by disordered eating, end of, you know, and that is valid. And so all these permutations of it, diabulimia, they didn't have a name back then. It was something with diabetes do this, I think. And sometimes men do it, you know, too, you know, it's all this stuff. The more that people are coming out and chatting about it, the more the future generations of people who hopefully will not have to suffer in silence, and there will be, fingers crossed, more funding and more services and stuff and professionals ready to help those who are in need. Because it's all well and good as well, I think. I've said a lot in the past, you know, just go and get help. Talk to your GP. That's hard. That's easier said than done. And also, I know that a lot of my recovery or recovered state has been with time. And I know that's a danger, that's a tricky or maybe dangerous thing to say, that, oh, it gets better in time. Mine got better in time in conjunction with help, outside help, and in conjunction with my life. I wasn't happy in what I was doing or where I was, so I moved, or I met different people and different life experiences occurred. I was miserable at high school, but I think everyone was, you know, and that's when the stuff developed. And so I think it's hard if some people feel maybe that they can't go to their GP or if they can't talk to someone. Like, there definitely are people out there, but I don't want people to think they have to wait for someone else's permission to get better.
Yeah.
Because I certainly did. I jumped the queue a bit. I received help because I was diabetic. It was my diabetic health specialist team who were like, something is going weird with your readings, Lawrence. What the hell's going on? And it took a while, but eventually they were like, honey, I think you've got an eating disorder. And because I was already in the system, and because diabetes has serious health implications, they could kind of rush me along to go to childhood. Had a great time there. Very memorable. CAMHS. And then also when I then went to GP in London a few years back, being like, I'm really not feeling very well. And I have a history of eating disorders. They're like, oh, okay, well, we'll see what we can do. I was like, and I'm a type 1 diabetic. They're like, oh, we'll see what we can do. And that kind of rushed things along as well. But then what is tricky is then when I then started to engage in this help, they're like, oh, diabetes, okay. But then they weren't as well equipped to deal with it. They didn't really know what diabetes was, or the grind of it, the holistic approach to it, that just kind of how it just kind of touches everything. Whereas they were trained in mental health things. So the eating disorders, the self-harm, the depression, that, you know, that was more of a, that was in their wheelhouse. So even though the diabetes got me in the room, once I was in the room, people, I didn't know who to talk to, or they didn't know how to talk to me. So it's a double-edged sword in a way. And I think in some ways it's interesting that a lot of things that have improved, they're not perfect at all, but a lot of things that have improved are my mood and self-harm, for example, and the eating disorder. The diabetes is still it's a tricky thing. And I think maybe because not as much attention was paid to it at the time when I really needed it. And so hopefully as more understanding comes about, and more research and stuff like this, and more people talking about it, people in the future will be a bit in a better position to receive help.
Do you think that's what's needed then? Do you think it is more training, more understanding, or do you think there's more specific things that either the people that were on your diabetes team or the mental health team, you know, is there things that they could do more, or is it just the understanding?
I don't know. I mean, it's every man for themselves. It's on an individual basis. I don't know. But I mean, one thing they could do, for example, when I go for my diabetic clinic and before I get seen by the doctor, I get my bloods taken, my height and my weight. And they do the weight first usually, and they say it very loudly across the room to someone else. And I look down and there it is, and I can see it. I'm like, oh, I've actually avoided scales for 2 years, but here we go. Cool. Thrilled to be here. Thank you so much. And it gets announced, and even from that, I don't really want to hear, oh, and then you have to kind of explain why you don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear the numbers. And you're like, oh God, why am I worried about numbers? I thought I was past this. And anyway, and then they do your blood pressure right afterwards. And every time they kind of go, oh my God, you got really high blood pressure. I'm like, you just wait 30 seconds until that fucking trauma's out of the way. And then it comes down again. So maybe if it could just say somewhere on my notes, don't announce his weight to the room.
I think that's a general statement overall, because I've got the implant, and I went for a checkup to just make sure that it was doing what it needed to be doing and it was happy. The man said to me, can you get on the scales? And I was like, I can, but I'd prefer if you didn't say what my weight is, because I do have a history of an eating disorder. And I got on the scales and he went, mumbled it out loud. And I was like, I'm sorry, did you just hear what I said? And then, you know, fortunately now I am in a very comfortable place where I can walk away, I can reflect on what's happened, I can think, why did that hurt me? And I then don't go back to past behaviors. But if that was me a few years ago,
that is such a good sign of growth. It's the thing of like, oh, the thing happened, but I didn't action it, or the event happens. You have the reaction, or you have the thought and then the reaction, but then the event happens, you have the thought, and that's when the element of choice comes in, or that's when I could do this or I could do that before, let's say the eating disorder muscles, like, well, you're going to have to go to the gym, hon, off you go. Whereas now it's like, okay, fork in the road. Do I go to the gym? Do I go about my day? Because I've got work later. Actually, I need to feed my cat. I need to, X, Y, Z. You know, there's other things to do. Which one takes precedence right now? In the past, each sort of would win every single time. And that's why my grades were in the toilet and I had a terrible social life and all this stuff. Whereas now I've got a bit more recovery breeds plurality.
Yeah.
Of choice, and of like, okay, there's a life outside of purely an eating disorder, which is a nice thing to have.
And I've said this so many times on this podcast that people listening probably think, here she goes again, but I personally do think that is recovery. I think some people might get full recovery or whatever full recovery even is, but for me it's the, like you said, the thing happens, the thought happens, make a choice that probably different it was to what you did when you're in the depth of an eating disorder.
Yeah because I don't think anyone really would like love their weight to be announced to a room, and I know plenty of people who don't have an eating disorder, but so I'm kind of like, oh, they announced my weight in the room. It's like, okay, well, they did that for every other patient. And it's how you engage with that.
I was very impressed, actually. Another tangent, but the other day I did a skydive, which was awesome.
Okay.
But they said you have to be below a certain weight to do the tandem, and so they were like, could you get onto the scales? And I was like, yeah, okay. Got onto the scales. They didn't say a word, which I was like, thank you very much. You didn't need to announce it to the whole queue behind me. I didn't need to know. You've just put it in your notes to say she can skydive.
Damn right you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was blooming brilliant as well. I'm going to do something that, like what we were talking about before, when you were like, I'm going to talk to a friend over lunch or whatever. So my brain is being like, whoa, you've been talking for ages. You should stop now. But I still have more questions. So we're going to go over the time limit that I normally set.
Oh, myself. My gosh. I know.
As long as you're okay first with that.
Yeah, sure.
We've spoken about diabetes and diabulimia. I want to talk to you about sexuality and the impact, if any, that you think that might have had on the development of your eating disorder.
Again, I don't know, because I've never not been gay. I don't know, and I of course knew that there was something different about me. But I was in such a low mood, a state of prolonged low mood, that I, and also with eating disorder, completely like reduced libido. And so I wasn't experiencing the feelings I thought I should have been feeling at the time, according to common knowledge of teenagers and what I was seeing at school. Like, I could see other people had girlfriends. I was like, I don't really want one of those. No offense to the one I did have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I know.
It's she's not listening.
No. But honestly, such a nice person. But just, I was gay. And sad. And I was mentally ill. Not the best person to be around. So I don't know. I think I had, in some ways, it's like, okay, this is happening, that's happening, that's happening. I'm gay, sure, chuck it on the fire. Everything else is burning anyway. It just felt like just another thing of like, this. Here's the thing. But I honestly didn't feel the need to come out. I didn't feel the need to do any of that, because I had convinced myself that I was so unworthy of love. No matter how I declared myself in regards to my sexuality, it wasn't going to be reciprocated, or no one's going to take me up on the offer, was the thought that I had. And I was so, I was so devoid of so many feelings and so many emotions that sexuality or love or anything like that, it just felt completely foreign to me. It felt like it was a language that I could not speak. So there's no point in me learning it. I have never phrased it like that before. It just wasn't, it was not on my radar whatsoever. Not to say that I didn't occasionally dabble. Would happen occasionally, which is lovely. I know it was terrifying, but it would happen occasionally. But again, I would then back it up with, they felt sorry for you. That's the only reason they did that. Or they hated that. They're never going to do that again. Oh, they did it again? Well, that was just to see. No, they definitely hate it. Or this person was put up to it by a mate, is a thoughts you'd have. Or why did they do that? Why, there's other people they could have chosen. Why did, is it just because I was there? You know, I would constantly try and come up with some excuse for why someone wanted to be with me. And they're all pretty outlandish, as you can tell. And then, I think I came out, as it were, with having mental health issues before coming out as gay. So that was, is that right? Yeah, I think it was actually. And you know what? Everyone around me was like, no shit, Sherlock, when I came out. But that doesn't make it any easier. Like, I was very lucky that when I came out with the person I'm with 9 years later. So for me, I had an anchor when I said to my parents, like, there's someone I'm seeing and I like them and they're a boy. They were just like, cool, when do we meet him? Why is he not here at this lunch that you've orchestrated? That was lucky. But in terms of me at 15, so that's in like 2000 and something, 2009 or something, like I wasn't on social media, or social media wasn't as rife as it is now. There wasn't such a proliferation of aspirational body types, really. There were in the movies, or there were in things like that, but whereas now, if you if you type in hashtag something or other, you know, you can't move for all these bodies, and of gay men, and of them living quite hedonistic lifestyles, which for me in Scotland just felt very other to me. So again, I kind of pushed all these things away because I thought, well, that's never going to be available to me. So I didn't have these aspirational body types that I was striving for. So for me, it was never a case of muscle gain or trying to get a six pack or doing all this stuff. It wasn't that. It was absolutely the reduction of size for me. And in my student days, I once went to a gay bar in Glasgow. And I was like, oh, I think someone's trying to feel my bum. They were trying to steal my wallet. That's what that was. And that's okay. But I didn't invite any attention. I didn't want attention. I didn't want anyone to look at me. I didn't want to be viewed as a sexual person, which is a shame, because now that I'm 30, I'm like, I could have spent some of my wonder years a bit differently. I was compromised. It's hard, but what, now it's tricky. And I've had this discussion with my partner that I've got such a hatred, I do, of social media and how people are portraying themselves. And he's very right to call me up on it, being like, is it that you hate it, or are you a bit jealous, but you can't admit that because you've made such a thing of the eating disorder. do I actually hate it, or do I actually hate that it's not achievable for me? It's so complicated. And some people just take nice pictures of themselves and want to share those. I don't feel that I can do that. I just don't feel that I don't want to do that. And it's taking some, that's my current project of just trying to re-examine my negative relationship with social media. Cause I've been quite judgy about it, and like, look at that. Oh my God. Oh, they've probably stood in front of the mirror for minutes trying to get that picture. Okay. Well, so what? It doesn't make them a bad person. What is it that I don't like about that? So that's something
I always try and flip it on its head as well. Like, you know, if you go to I went to the gym the other day, and there was this guy, and he was walking around, and he kept lifting up his top, checking his abs, and he kept taking pictures of himself, blah, blah, blah. And initially I was like, oh, for God's sake. And then I thought, no, he is probably really, really struggling with something. Mm. Maybe what you see as like a lean, ripped stomach, he doesn't see that, and he's checking, or maybe he's checking to make sure it's still there. And it's all, you know, it's all thoughts that I've had myself, you know, I've struggled with that myself. So then for me, when I then look at people and judge them, I'm like, well, that's wrong because you've been there. And that's definitely something I'm working on, is kind of having, I guess, just compassion for other people, you know, if they do display themselves in a different light. And I've had this conversation with one of my friends so many times. Like, you know, why are they doing that? They're probably not doing it because they're super confident and they want everybody to see what they look like. They're probably doing it because they need that appraisal from other people because they're not getting it from themselves.
And my gut reaction is always to go like, yeah, but are they happy? To try and make myself feel better. Because Lawrence, are you happy? Like, what I like to stand on, hun? Like, I don't know. I think I rally against a lot of it because I feel that, you know, a lot of undue importance is placed on aesthetics and physical appearance. So maybe I'm trying to readdress that balance and be like, it doesn't matter what you look like, but maybe I've taken that to slightly too far a point, because now I'm turning up places looking like shit or I'm not making the effort with myself. And my partner has pointed out that, like, you know, sometimes like doing your hair or just dressing up nicely actually does have a reaction.
Yeah.
In that you start to feel a bit better about yourself. I mean, lockdown was hard, and that's hardly newsworthy. I was constantly like wearing just like joggy bottoms and just crap. And you're like, oh, feels horrible. Not saying if I walked around with like a 3-piece suit, I would have felt dandy, but like just making a bit of the effort, because making the effort. And as you say, for the people around you, like my boyfriend doesn't want to see me just wearing my pajamas all day. Like, it's what I think is so hard. Well, not so hard, but I think what is interesting is that so much I've attributed so much of my life or spent so much of my life fixated on the eating disorder and the depression and a bit of that there's the danger that it has made me quite a selfish person, because I've spent so much time inwardly looking and making excuses and, oh, well, actually I went through this really dramatic thing when I was, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay. But that doesn't help my boyfriend when we're having an argument, or if I haven't, you know, or if I'm not picking up that phone message to that friend who might need me more than I think, or I don't know. It's tricky. There comes a point when you kind of go, okay, enough. Like, or I don't know. It's if the listeners are listening to this and they're thinking he is making no sense, is because I'm thinking out loud right now, or it's yeah. very this is not an area that I'm comfortable with, and it's something that I need to be doing a bit of work on.
But I actually think that listening to you sort of go back and forth and not quite know what you're saying is actually so important to hear, because I think pretty much most of the people I have on this podcast are very far along in recovery. You know, they've been doing it for a while, or they're fully recovered or whatever. It's not, I mean, I don't tend to have people that have got an eating disorder on the podcast, but the thing that we then lack is sort of that, what the hell is going on in my life right now? I don't understand. Why am I doing this? I want to stop, but I can't stop. I need to stop. Everybody wants me to stop, but I just need to keep doing this.
Yeah.
And we've all felt like that. That's why it persisted for so long. But now we've, you know, I've been in recovery for nearly 10 years now. I've had 10 years worth of therapy. I've had 10 years of trying to work this stuff out, trying to understand why it's still lingering, why it happened in the first place.
Yeah.
That's a long time. So for somebody listening that's still in the depth of an eating disorder thinking, do I want to recover? I don't know. Why am I doing this? You know, us sitting here saying, oh yeah, so when I was 14, I developed an eating disorder and I went to the doctor and they referred me on and I had some therapy and now I'm great.
Yeah.
It's lovely to hear, and it's lovely to hear that you can recover. But, you know, that messiness, I think, is so refreshing to hear as well, to know that, you know, everybody's been there when you don't have your shit together and you just want to scream and you just want it to leave you alone for 5 seconds, but you can't.
Yeah, because it touches every part. It has the capability to affect all different sorts of your life, and it's that thing of, okay, well, who am I without this? Who am I without or without just completely removing an eating disorder thought pattern from the equation is a really hard piece of maths to do.
I think the majority of people that I've spoken to that have had an eating disorder thrive on labels. And, you know, whether that's, you know, for me, it was Hannah the anorexic, or Hannah the girl that always got straight A's, Hannah the powerlifter. I'm now at a place in my life where I'm kind of just Hannah. And Hannah still does loads of different stuff. But when I like meet people, there's nothing that, you know, when I powerlifted, that was all I ever spoke about. But now I'm like, I have a lot of different things I can talk about, which is so much better. But equally, it's sometimes quite an uncomfortable place to be in, and that it's quite a vulnerable place of, I'm just Hannah.
Like, yeah. And that is enough. Yeah. I needed to add on Lawrence, who had an eating disorder. Lawrence, who, because as I say, I thought that made me remarkable when, I don't know, probably like the sixth most interesting thing about me, maybe, you know, like if I'm being kind to myself, like there's other, you are more than just your eating disorder. You're way more than just it than that. And which when you're not feeling too great about yourself can be hard to hear, but you are more.
You are. Well, I genuinely feel like I could talk to you for the rest of my life. So hopefully that will happen. I have two questions that I ask at the end of each podcast. So I'm going to do those.
How sweaty am I right now?
I have reduced a lot in sweat. When we started this, my face was glowing. I mean, I was dripping. I'm now... Have you increased in sweat?
Well... A little bit, yeah.
Good. Well,
but that's okay. I'm basking in it now.
Good.
It's happened.
Yeah, that's what you have to do. I'm going to have to remember the questions now. My brain is just, sure. I feel like we've done so much revealing of like turning stones upside down that my brain, mm-hmm. I think I'm going to be going to sleep straight after this. The questions. Okay, first one. So, and this is, I think, is quite a good one. We're going to do this specifically for diabulimia, which kind of already spoke about. So obviously the people that are listening to this podcast, maybe they don't know about diabulimia. Maybe it's something people haven't heard of, but are probably going to know about eating disorders because that's why they're listening to an eating disorder awareness podcast, which is great. And thank you, everybody. But how do you think we reach those people that have no idea what an eating disorder is?
First of all, I completely forgot that this is a podcast and people will listen to this. Thrilling to be reminded at the end. I was like, we're just having a chat.
Did you think we were just having a casual chat? Well, that's really cute.
Anyway, maybe censor some things. This sounds stupid, but I, in the time of being ill, would latch onto anything I could find in the media. And there was a storyline on Hollyoaks. Never watched an episode in my life. I became a fan because of there was a character who had an eating disorder. And in a time when I was like, I feel very, very alone. Something's wrong with me, but I don't know what it is. And then I was like, oh, is it that? Okay, I'm going to follow this story. And of course, it's sensationalized and... I don't know, she probably got kidnapped and all this stuff. Didn't happen to me. But, and again, that was tricky because that was a person who wasn't me, of a gender that wasn't mine and of a sexuality that wasn't mine and having experiences that were very not mine. But seeing an eating disorder on TV was hugely powerful. And I don't know, and so I'm not, you know, a massive like soap watcher or not like things, but if I hear rumblings of, oh, there's an eating sort of storyline, I'll check it out. I'll see what's going on. And because so many people tune into these, so many people watch TV or so many people listen to podcasts. Hey. Especially now, holy moly, past couple of years, that's something that's binding a lot of people together is media, which is and something that I find really tricky. This is a bit of a tangent, sorry. I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan.
Me too. I hope you love Taylor Swift.
Oh my god. Anyway, huge fan. But when she stood up there accepting Album of the Year at the Grammys for 1989, she's been heralded with the biggest award on the biggest night in a huge industry. Millions of eyes are watching her. And I'm sitting there going, I don't think she's very well. Or like, she's so thin. And yet it was never talked about. And of course, I can't say that people should talk about it. But then a couple of years later, when she did Miss Americana, her documentary on Netflix, she talks about having an eating disorder, or she talks about she was going through periods of starving herself. And because of the intense media scrutiny and all the photos. And what was hard is she is one of the most globally recognized. She's a huge star. And she was publicly having an eating disorder and it was not discussed. And I'm not trying to pressure someone to come out and have an eating disorder, you know, and it's a very private thing, of course. But we could all see the physical signs of that is a low weight person. That doesn't need to be an eating disorder, of course not, but no one's talking about, and that felt a bit gaslighty a bit, because also she's a huge icon for so many people. And so I'm not, Taylor, if you're listening to this, I love you. But this is,
if she's listening to this, then oh my god.
Oh my god. We've done something right, baby. You're totally right. But so I think that's tying into the media or the general public. How do we ingest a lot of stuff. It's through Twitter. It's through water cooler moments about, oh my God, did you see such and such last night? Or do you watch the new HBO drama? Or I don't know, things like it would, can you hear the sirens? They're really pissing me off.
That's no, a weird
like,
one.
Shut up, go home. But things, I don't know, even like Grey's Anatomy, so sorry, but they're so thin on that damn show. Mm-hmm. And but there's a huge prevalence of mental health issues and eating disorders in the medical community. So maybe it would do be really cool if we actually said, like, hey, we know like we're unrealistic beauty standards and we're placing them on our female cast members and male cast members, actually. Hey, let's talk about it and talk about it because they know people are watching.
Yeah. I think you're so right. I think what needs to happen more is we need to have conversations about somebody having an eating disorder without it being a death sentence.
Yes.
Because at the moment, all that happens is it's when it's a tragedy, which obviously needs to, you know, we need to be talking about that because it can happen. But also mm-hmm. I hate the fact that, you know, in my head always is parents going to a clinic with their child and the child being diagnosed and the parent thinking, well, that's it. I can't do anything. That's a death sentence, because that's how it is spoken about. Not in the eating disorder, I guess, community, if you want to call it that, but outside, in the outside world, that's kind of what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's such a gradual thing trying to like change the hearts and minds of the great British public, of course. My God. But yeah, I don't know, you never know what impact, and maybe it doesn't, so maybe a tweet of so-and-so from such and such has revealed, you know, that might mean nothing to 99% of the great British public, but for those, and I'm speaking for those young guys, those young lads, or people who feel a bit excluded even from the eating disorder narrative, then they're like, oh wow, okay, they've got it. Maybe, well, and you know, it just hopefully opens up communication points for them too. So yeah, I mean, maybe it's just a boring old answer, but just how do we get more people to talk about it, show it more, talk about it more.
Yeah. Okay, second question.
Which is my favorite Taylor Swift album? Oh my God, I don't know. Folklore, obviously. I don't know. Nevermore? I don't know. They've both got bops. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Thank you for that great insight there. I'm really glad. That can go on your wiki page.
Absolutely. I assume
being an actor and singer, you've got a wiki page. If you haven't, you should make one.
Not yet. Anyway.
You'll get one.
Well, if Taylor Swift is listening to this, you know,
she'll be making it for you.
Absolutely.
Second question, your top tip or your best advice for somebody who's looking to get support for their eating disorder?
Oh, shit. Okay, the first thing I thought of was be honest.
Yep.
Don't know why I thought that, but okay, let's run with it. Be honest. Why did I say that? Because, maybe going back to what I said earlier, the pain that you are experiencing is valid. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be on... I mean, so you don't need to be on the most extreme side of things, but unfortunately, in some cases, that is what gets you in the door. But we're talking about, oh God, okay, track back, Lawrence. Help doesn't just mean a GP, or it doesn't just mean, it can be a parent, it can be a friend, it can be a loved one, it can be someone you work with, it can be something. And if, if you kind of give them half the story, then they might then try and respond to the half that you've given them, but then that kind of ignores the other bit, and maybe there's other. What am I thinking? I think if they've even engaged in the activity of seeking help, that already shows humongous strength, which is absolutely should be lauded and just celebrated. that even in the worst time and the worst that they're feeling, and they might feel powerless at times in the face of the eating disorder, they have got themselves to the stage where they can ask for help. Mm. And so even though it might be a small voice, like you're shining a light in the darkness to yourself. And I think that is a huge step. And everything else that comes from that, if you manage to do that, then hey, like you've got strength in you, and you can get out. Like, oh God, I don't know. It's hard. Like, it's quite it's quite an emotional thing, because if anyone is listening and they are struggling, they don't really know what to do, then you have you've got my absolute sympathy, because it's not a place that I would wish on anyone. And the fact that this person, whoever's listening, is going through it, I'm really sorry. That's really sad. I'm really sorry for you. But hey, as we discussed, it's not the end. It's a chapter in your life, but it is not the entire book. Oh my God. That's what I'd say. I would say it's a chapter in your life, but it's not the entire book, baby.
Woohoo!
There we go. God, we got there in the end. Holy crap. Oof.
Right. I adored that conversation in every single way, which why I think it's happened possibly for about an hour and 40 minutes, which I think is just fantastic.
Listen.
Yeah.
I say a lot, so you're going to have, you'll cut down like 2 hours worth of me going, don't make me sound stupid though. Like, give me a bit of, you know.
I will make you sound incredible, because you already sound incredible. So
there we go. That's what we're looking for. I keep forgetting people are listening to this. Dear.
Well, I hope they've enjoyed it as much as I have. Bless. It's been so lovely to chat to you.
You too, Sunshine. Thank you.
And may it continue.
I absolutely loved that episode with Lawrence, and I think one of my main takeaways was, we often say, oh, you know, how did that influence your eating disorder? But at the end of the day, that's our life, so how are we meant to understand that? Next week, I'll be joined by Alice McBain, and together we talk about disordered eating, sexuality, mental health, therapy, and medication.
With the expectations that we have on the way society expects the kind of general man to look and the general woman to look. For example, if you're a trans woman, you might feel the pressure to slim down, because there's these expectations of women to be slim, but to have boobs and a bum at the moment, because that's the trend in women's bodies. And there are also non-binary people, and people don't believe them when they say they're non-binary, because they're like, well, you have big boobs, so you can't be non-binary, as if that's mutually exclusive and things like that. So, you know.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.